This is Molly McElroy recording an oral history with Mary Bricott Edwards. So just to start things off, did you grow up as a local to Connecticut, or were you born somewhere else outside?
I was actually born in Illinois, but I grew up in California. So my whole childhood was in California, Southern California.
And were you always had a connection to the maritime singing?
Yeah. So my father was the first mate on a square rigged sailing ship, which was named the Yankee. So he sailed twice around the world as first mate. It was a sail training vessel, and his captain was Irving Johnson. And so then after that, the second trip was, I was actually born during the second trip. And then after that, he worked in oceanographic research. He worked as a sailor. He worked on oceanographic research vessels. He wasn't, the captain or one of the scientists, but just one of the workers. And so he was in that field all his life. And then we had a boat from the time I was little. And then when I was 16 and my sister Katrina was 15 and my brother Sean was 10, we sailed around the world on a 38-foot ketch. And we spent 3 years and 7 months at sea. And then after that, I've spent the rest of my life working at Mystic Seaport Museum. And before I started working in the museum, I also taught at sea and on sail training vessels. I taught literature and history. So, yeah, my whole life is maritime.
So you sail all around the world, I suppose. It's any particular examples that you saw during your time?
Yeah, so we were gone for 3 years and 7 months and sailed 38,000 miles, which is pretty amazing when you think that the boat averaged around 5 miles an hour. So it was pretty slow. And we sailed through the South Pacific, sailed down the coast of Mexico, through the South Pacific, to New Zealand, Australia, across the Indian Ocean, then down around the Cape of Good Hope, down at the bottom of Africa, and all the way up to Gloucester, Massachusetts, then down the east coast of the United States, through the Panama Canal, and back home to the town I grew up in, which was Santa Barbara, California.
So what in particular drew you to Connecticut after all that time sailing?
So when we when my father had been on the square rigger, the Brigantine Yankee, he had in between the world voyages, so they usually sailed for about 18 months. That was how long a world voyage would take. And then they would spend the 18 months in between the voyages making money for the next voyage. And one of the ways they made money was to take out Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts sailing. And so during that was all done sort of in New England. And on those voyages, my father visited Mystic Seaport Museum many times, and he really fell in love with it. And so when I was growing up, we always knew about the museum, even though we were in California. And then when we sailed around the world, when my own family sailed around the world, we visited Mystic Seaport, and I fell in love with it too. And I was like, oh, this is a great place. So we returned home to California at the end of April, and I was going to go to university in the fall, and I needed a summer job. So I applied to Mystic and came back, and I actually worked in the Conrad program and spent a summer working at the museum and totally loved it. And then I went on and got my BA and my MA and my PhD, and while I was getting my PhD, I started coming back and working at the museum in summers. And then after I graduated with my PhD, then I started working at the museum year-round. So it was completely Mystic Seaport that brought me to Connecticut. I never, when I was growing up in California, I never thought, oh, I want to live in Connecticut. But I always wanted to work at Mystic Seaport.
I would understand that you were around during the restoration of the Charles W. Morgan and being able to see that 38th voyage. Would you like to describe that experience of being able to see her in action once again?
So in the years before the restoration happened, the Morgan, you know, she was not in good shape. She was getting sort of in worse shape, and they were trying to raise the money to restore her, and we were able to do less and less. You know, we eventually couldn't set, you know, at first we could set a lot of sails, and then fewer and fewer sails, and like they took the chain sheets off the lower topsails because that was too much weight aloft, and eventually we couldn't set any sails on the ship, and we could raise and lower the whaleboat, but that was all. And it was becoming, you know, just less and less because we were trying to protect the ship, and they were having a really hard time raising all the money until President Steve White came up with the idea of sailing her, and all of a sudden it got everybody excited and interested. So I was actually at the staff meeting when he announced it, and we couldn't quite believe it. We're all like, did he just say that? Are we going to sail the ship? And he didn't tell the staff until he cleared it first with the Coast Guard, which took about, you know, a long time, several years, I think, to get the clearance from the Coast Guard to be allowed to do it, and then cleared it with the Board of Trustees. So it was an amazingly well-kept secret. I couldn't believe that they kept the secret so well. And then suddenly they announced that they had them, that we were going to seal it, and that really increased donations. People were so excited about it. And so then the restoration just started in earnest. And we had, you know, as they were trying to finish everything to do with the ship, then they got a very large grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities to send the, what they called 38th Voyagers, which were people like scholars and ethnomusicologists and artists and sculptors and musicians and descendants of whalemen and school teachers and, you know, Neville scholars, all kinds of different people, 9 of them on each passage. There were over 85 of them, and that was a huge international, actually, a contest to be allowed to be one of those voyagers, and that helped by getting that money. And so that all led to the voyage. And then the Susan Funk, she's the executive vice president and chief operating officer at the museum. She was determined that the boat wouldn't just be sailed by, you know, sailors or outsiders. She wanted to make sure that anybody who worked at the museum had the chance to sail on it. So they allowed staff to apply for staff positions as crewmen. Staff sailors each sailed 1/3 of the voyage. And then they hired some professional crew, and then they allowed every single person who worked at the museum, if they wanted to, people who worked in, you know, finance, people who worked in facilities, people who are groundskeepers, everybody, curatorial, each got a chance to go out for one day. So pretty much everybody did that. So that's how it happened. And it was interesting because even though we were just staff sailors and they were professional sailors, we actually, many of us knew a lot more about the Morgan because most of the professional sailors were people from schooners. They weren't used to square riggers, and we, you know, we are used to not only square riggers, but actually that square rigger. We knew more about the Morgan, you know, certainly than any of the professional sailors, because we'd all spent years on her.
Sort of slightly shifting gears, going back just a tad to look at sort of the education aspect of maritime that you have a lot of experience in. You said you taught maritime education on board a ship, is that correct?
Yes. So when I first got my PhD, I was teaching for Long Island University, had a at-sea program, and also Northeastern University. So Long Island University, obviously, on Long Island, New York, and Northeastern University's in Boston, Massachusetts. And I was the history and literature professor, so the students would spend the entire semester at sea And then I would give them classes, you know, just like students do with SEA or Williams Mystic these days. And at that time, I would teach them a class, you know, on literature and history. And then they would get credit that could transfer to their schools from either Long Island University or from Northeastern. So, and I also had a captain's license, so I was especially, I was somebody good for them to hire because sail training vessels were required to have two people with licenses aboard, and if, you know, the captain obviously had a license, and then if they could use me as their second license, but just pay me to be the teacher, you know, it made economic sense for them, and it was, you know, it was great for me. So, yeah, so I did that for a while, and then eventually I was kind of sick of being at sea, and I started teaching for Williams Mystic, and then from there, when University of Connecticut decided to ramp up their Maritime Studies program, I already taught maritime literature, so I got hired, as did Glenn Gournier, who already taught maritime history. We were both hired so that they could sort of start, you know, with people who are already recognized in the field. And that kind of was a big boost to the program because it sort of made the program already sort of, look really serious, not just look like somebody said, yeah, I'd like to be on boots, you know, that kind of thing. So Glenn and I were both hired at the same time.
Your sort of specialty when it comes to maritime literature, from my understanding, is Herman Melville. What about him as an author interests you, either from a maritime perspective or an English perspective?
So when I first went to graduate school, I was really interested in Henry James, another American author. So I was obviously already interested in 19th century American. But so I was kind of studying James, and then my major professor, whose name was Harrison Hayford, he has now passed away, but at the time he was the leading Herman Melville scholar in the United States. He looked at me and he said, with your background, you should study Melville. And it was kind of funny because I was just, I was just an undergraduate. I hadn't really thought about things too much. And I was like, oh, okay, if that's what my teacher says. And then now I can't imagine ever studying anybody else. But he thought that Melville would work for me because I already loved 19th century American literature, and I was a sailor, so those two things combined, and that's how I got into Melville. And now, as you know, having been my student, I just loved Melville and love Moby Dick.
Thank you so much for...
you're welcome. Thanks for a great set of questions. You did a really good job.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being a part of this interview today, and I hope you have a very good day.